This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to LGIM Talks and to the first episode of Fixed Income in Focus, a new series for 2024 where we chat with members of LGIM's active fixed income team about the key drivers of bond markets, the technical aspects of fixed income, and what's front of mind for our fund managers. My guest today is Matt Rees, Head of Global Bond Strategies. Matt has been a fund manager for the last 25 or so years, 15 of which I believe have been spent at LGIM. In his spare time, he's a keen hockey player and coach to boot. That's an impressive track record on both counts, actually, Matt. Matt, welcome to Fixed Income in Focus. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very good.
Good. Well, look, should we go from hockey to serious stuff? Not that hockey isn't, but and start with the macro first. I just want to say, you know, going into the real economy, if that's how you put it, and in terms of economy, certainly in the Western world, we're seeing what seems to be a divergence. We've got growth, quite hot growth in the US, but quite cool growth in Europe, haven't we? I wonder, Matt, does that mean we're seeing a divergence in the way the underlying bond markets are behaving?
There has been actually quite surprising, really, given, you know, some of the big growth differentials that are going on. But there's actually been quite convergent expectations of the number of rate cuts across the US, Europe, and also the UK, where the UK economy is also expected to be quite weak. So we've moved from around about kind of 6.5 to 7 rate cuts that were expected by the end of 2024, at the end of last year, to between 3 and 4-ish rate cuts now. So even with that diverging growth, there's still quite similar expectations for what central banks will do. The one thing, I suppose, is the number of cuts in Europe is expected to be higher, over 4 rate cuts by the end of the year, even though, you know, Europe's starting from a much lower level of kind of government base rates, which does reflect the more negative sentiment around European growth. And the key reason for this is there's a big disinflation wave. So the level of inflation has been going down quite rapidly, particularly because goods prices, which were jacked up because of COVID, are now starting to go down. But that's fairly well cemented across the countries. Also, central banks, you know, very much signal that current interest rates are restrictive. They're a long way above what they think the neutral level of interest rates will be. And that inflation has peaked. And that's part of the reason why there has been some convergence of expectations around where interest rates would go to.
So, I mean, you're still talking about the narrative of peak interest rates then. But do you want to put in any caveats? Because since the beginning of the year, we've seen very strong US job report and stronger than expected US inflation footprint earlier this week. Are we still absolutely sure that it's peak and then fall at some stage?
I think we're still pretty confident in that. And when you go back and really think about, say rates in the US are around about, you know, the government rates are around about 5.25% to 5.5%. And the Fed and most economists think that the neutral rate, you know, of where interest rates should be is around about 2 to 2.5%. So rates are very much restrictive when you think that they're about almost 3% above where neutral could be. No one really knows where it is. And therefore, even if growth is quite strong, the central banks have signaled, and they're correct, that it is still kind of like, you know, slowing things down in the economy, and therefore some rate cuts will happen. Obviously, with the big, you know, stronger than expected US inflation data yesterday, the number of those cuts is changing, but we do still think we have seen peak rates and that cuts do need to happen. Rates need to go down, official rates need to go down a little bit.
So does that mean that the dots are all moving around?
The dots move around like crazy.
Yeah.
But quite a lot of volatility in government bond yields, volatility in the curves. But these are all things that have been happening for quite some time. And volatility is quite good. It makes the days pass quicker, and it gives us good opportunities as active managers to take advantage of it as well.
Okay, so we've mentioned developed markets there for a bit. But of course, the other feature of this year has been weakness and deflation, I think, in China, hasn't it? To what extent will this impact global growth overall, Matt?
I think expectations are pretty low for what China's going to do. I mean, and people have got used to the fact that China, post the financial crisis, China was probably generating around about a third of global GDP growth. And particularly in the last 2 years, they've come out of their longer COVID lockdown. They haven't generated much growth. So it's the expectations are very, very low for what China's going to do. The really interesting part for us is how much deflation that's happening in China. So their producer price index, so how much factory, you know, goods cost when they come out of the gate, that's been negative for quite some time. That does drive deflation globally. So therefore, they're kind of thinking about global growth and global inflation. China has been a source of global deflation. The other bit on the other side of that is there has been, because of geopolitical constraints, there's been a lot of pressure on companies to offshore from China. So whether that be producing in Vietnam or really kind of reshoring back to the US or parts of Europe, that does cause some inflationary pressure. But that the impetus of China driving global growth has gone. And I think that's fully expected at the moment.
So on the flip side, then, if you're turning that round and you're saying that actually, at least I think what you're saying is China is not as important to global growth as it once was, does that mean if it stimulates its economy, we won't feel the benefits either?
No, that is it's a key question that everybody does consider. If China really does, you know, throw the towel in on their relatively restrictive kind of monetary stimulus at the moment, then it does potentially have a very big impact globally. So it could force some increases in inflation globally. It could also contribute to global growth. The one thing is that when we really stand back and think about it, can you read the mind of President Xi? No, you can't. So your ability to forecast when and where stimulus may come in, I think, is very, very limited. You're taking a punt. We don't like to take punts. But you can see the pressure they're under. They have started to do some, you know, more liquidity injections into the banking sector. They're trying to divert funds into the real estate sector to get that moving again. But it's pretty difficult. And at the moment, they haven't launched a big monetary or fiscal bazooka.
And interestingly, I mean, we've gone, China is in the doldrums, but back in Europe, so is Germany. And I'm just wondering, given that the fiscal conservatism going on there, no stimulus, well, certainly not a bazooka, as you say, is likely there either, is it?
Yeah, it's very difficult for Germany because the Constitutional Court put the kibosh on them actually being able to spend about 100, 125 billion euros. And they have, yeah, they've had to very rapidly do an about turn on some fiscal stimulus they were hoping. But when we look at Europe as a whole, there's still quite a big difference because there's still a lot of money left over to be spent, and particularly in the periphery, so in Spain and Italy, for example, from COVID funds that were raised centrally. And as long as they meet certain objectives, for example, Spain has still got about 100 billion or more of fiscal money from central Europe they can spend. So parts of Europe are still benefiting from fiscal spending. And one of the things when we think globally about how important it can be and where it's going to come from, we're looking very much at political structures. So where a political structure enables politicians to spend money, such as in the UK, the Conservatives have, you know, a majority in Parliament. If they want to do fiscal, they can do, versus in the US, where there's a split Parliament, it's harder. And therefore, we think about, you know, the potential for fiscal spending to come in when politicians are up against the wall, as they are in certain countries.
It's interesting because, I mean, we talked a bit about divergence or potential divergence at the top of the episode, but I'm sensing, is there a divergence then between European countries? And you mentioned the peripheral. Is that shaping your thinking in terms of European bonds? Is that, are you thinking, well, you know, I mean, I know we don't give advice on these podcasts, but are you thinking we potentially favour Spain and Italy to the detriment of Germany?
Yeah, we've definitely been thinking about that and have been looking at, say, particularly say Spain and against France. So debt levels are quite similar in both countries. Debt levels are quite high. But the Spanish fiscal position is better than it is in France. And we look at government bond yields and where they trade. And then also given that fiscal power that Spain and Italy have, because they're still spending central EU money, it makes us slightly more positive on some of the corporates or banks within those countries compared to others, particularly where they do trade at a premium versus a good solid German company, which are, you know, they're struggling with high energy prices in Germany, for example. That has a big impact on the industrial sector. So there are definitely interesting opportunities becoming available, which we're really looking at to take advantage of.
Okay, interesting. Now, of course, you've mentioned high energy prices, and high energy prices have been one of the feeders of inflation. I know we don't forecast inflation because it's so difficult, so we try to avoid it. But I can't let you get away without just a comment on yesterday's inflation numbers, which clearly took the market by surprise, given the fall in, certainly I was looking at the S&P yesterday and bond yields. I mean, when you think about this time last year, inflation has fallen, but has it fallen enough, and are there sticky elements now to it?
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question, literally, and it is very, very difficult. And the acceleration in disinflation, so how quickly inflation was falling, was really, really rapid over the last 12 months or so. And that, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, that was mainly because of the goods sector. So it's the easiest bit where your year-on-year really goes down because good prices were high. And you look at the graphs of how inflation has now started to move, it has definitely slowed down. So that the disinflation is starting to slow down, but there is still disinflation to some degree. So, you know, US core CPI is still going down on some measures. Going forward, therefore, it's really looking at the kind of the structure of the labour market. So how much wages are moving. And on some key wage measures, particularly ones that Fed look at, is wages are going down quickly enough relative to their very, very strong levels of growth. But there are also some very sticky parts, such as rent in the US is definitely, has still been shown signs of going up. So it's no longer an easy win that we have, structurally lower core inflation. But we still believe that acceleration of disinflation, it doesn't stop, and we don't see an increase in core inflation. But as you said, forecasting it's a fool's game, to be honest. Most forecasters are always wrong on inflation.
So given all that scenario, and when I look back, and I think I did the last podcast with the team, with Colin, the day after Jay Powell came out with that statement and the famous Fed pivot, thinking, whoa, what's happened here? With hindsight and that fabulous rally that we had in November and December, do you think the market went too far too fast?
Yeah, it definitely feels like the market did, and market got way too excited. So I said when I was talking at the beginning about the number of rate cuts expected, that peak of rate cuts of like near to 7 rate cuts in the US was around about that time of the Powell pivot. So the government bond market definitely got probably overexcited that was going to come in. And the Fed has since been trying to walk the market back towards its own dot plot forecast, which is saying there's only 3 rate cuts, and we're actually closer to that now. The bit that's interesting to me is when I look at government bond markets, yes, the market got too excited. The credit markets have had a kind of sideways trading range this year, but we are actually tighter in credit spreads, across all of the markets year to date. So, which is, definitely quite a different outcome you'd expect. If government bond yields rose in the past, credit spreads also rose. And the reason for that is because yields are still attractive to investors. We're seeing the demand for fixed income is still massive. And it was most interesting to me yesterday after that very big US inflation number, with that massive sell-off that we had in both equities and government bonds, there was a real pickup in demand, particularly for long-end US credit from yield-based buyers, which did surprise us, actually, and we took advantage of that.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a feature of I don't know how many months, these tighter credit spreads, isn't it? And I mean, the other thing is that in January, had a lot of debt issuance, didn't we? And that seemed to be well absorbed. So it really backs up what you're saying about people, flush with cash, putting it into areas still happy with the fundamentals.
They are. I mean, there's a definite, there's a kind of FOMO element of people wanting to, kind of fear of missing out. that is driving some people into fixed income. There's also a big increase in volumes of annuities being written now. So there was no point buying an annuity, whether you're an individual or a corporation, in the years pre-COVID. Whereas now, if you can get 5 to 6% in an annuity, it's quite attractive. Annuity buyers generally buy the long end of the market. And so we're seeing, you know, very big increases in annuity volumes being written in the US and the UK, for example. There was record issuance of US investment grade credit of about $195 billion in the US in January.
Wow.
Compared to expectations of $150 billion. And US credit still tightened. That really shows the strength of demand. And we do feel that's still quite strong. The technicals, it's called, is still very, very strong for fixed income.
Is it stronger than the fundamentals? So if you look at things according to two buckets, technicals and fundamentals, would you say it's a technically driven market at the moment?
It is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is.
Because again, if you think about weaknesses in economies. So the UK and European economy is going to be quite weak. We're going to be bumping around zero, possibly a small recession. European spreads at least pay you for that to some degree compared to, say, the US and the UK. But UK spreads on the whole now are getting quite expensive because that's the strength of technicals. And yet the UK could be in a recession. So there you can really see that strength of demand is overriding fundamentals.
And the worry, I suppose, is that the technicals don't reflect the fundamentals. And at some point,
it can break.
It can break.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this is where, again, we really look to the strength of our credit analysts and the bottom-up expertise that we have to make sure that we're ahead of that kind of potential tipping point wave. So where we have concerns about fundamentals, particularly also where we have concerns about M&A, that M&A is starting to increase in certain sectors, mainly in the US, that if that leads to weaker credit quality, then you have to be really, really kind of on top of that and making sure you don't have exposure to those companies, because at some point it can reach tipping point.
So it's a real bottom-up focus at the moment for those guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because if you think we're in late cycle behavior, possibly in the US, we're definitely, you know, round about recessionary problems in the UK and Europe. And in both of those types of markets, bottom-up, individual stock picking becomes more and more important. So that's why, kind of, for active managers, it's so important to get that right and to be really forward looking, which we are.
Okay. Well, look, we've talked about bottom up focus, Matt. But given this, that's quite nice, ties in quite nicely with our title, Fixed Income in Focus. What will you be focusing on in the next couple of months? I mean, will it be that, or will it be something else?
Primarily it is that. So really the underlying credit quality of the companies we're investing in is absolutely key. The bit that I'm also really looking at is actually the strength of the US consumer. So both particularly the wages that's going on and the spending power of the US consumer, particularly getting really geeky. That's what I do in fixed income. That's what we normally do, is the kind of the lower income consumers in the US, they have the highest propensity to consume. Their wages have really shot up post COVID and they're still quite high. If their wages are still good and their kind of their spending power is good, the US consumer spends money. The US consumer spends money, US economy does well. So it's really kind of trying to really focus in on what makes the marginal difference. The other thing as well is just keep on looking at that the technical. So is there still continued demand? So speaking to our colleagues in Chicago in our office there, speaking to our sales team around the world, particularly in Asia, about how much demand they're seeing from foreign investors for fixed income. And then in the UK, carry on speaking to our colleagues in Buy and Maintain the Annuity about the flows that are coming into their asset classes, which are huge as well, to really get a good broad sense of the strength of demand for fixed income. Because it's a difficult thing to rely on. You're normally looking on backward-looking data. So we spend a lot of time thinking as much as we can about forward-looking signs of the demand for fixed income.
Mm-hmm. It sounds as though you've got your spreadsheet next to us as we're talking. And it sounds as though you're going to be knee-deep in those for the next couple of months, well, probably all year. Matt, really interesting to talk to you. Thanks a lot for giving us a really good overview of your world at the moment. And keep on playing the hockey. Good luck. And thank you to you, and thank you all for listening. Thank you.
Thanks, Frances.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.